18 from 81, and what do you get? You get 63, the prophet's age when he died, peace be upon him. I heard a low chuckle from the back seat. Now one day a traveler was passing through, and of course he sat with Mullah Shakib for a meal that evening, as is custom. The traveler heard this story, and he thought about it. And then he said, "But Mullah Sahib, with all due respect, I met a Jew once, and I swear his poems bore the very same lines. How do you explain it?" And Mullah said, "Then the Jew was a Muslim at heart." Her sudden outburst of laughter bewitched me for the rest of the day. It was as though, God forgive me for this blasphemy, it had descended down on me from heaven itself, the garden of the righteous, as the book says, where rivers flow beneath, and perpetual are the fruits and the shade therein. Understand that it wasn't merely her beauty, Mr. Marcos, that had me so spellbound, though that alone might have been enough. I had never in my life encountered a young woman like Nila. Everything she did, the way she spoke, the way she walked, dressed, smiled, was a novelty to me. Nila pushed against every single notion I had ever had of how a woman was to behave, a trait that I knew met with the stout disapproval of people like Zahid, and surely Sabur too, and every man in my village and all the women, but to me, it only added to her already enormous allure and mystery. And so, her laughter still rang in my ears as I went about my work that day. And later, when the other workers came over for tea, I grinned and muted their cackles with the sweet tinkle of her laughter. And I prided myself on knowing that my clever story had given her a bit of reprieve from the discontent of her marriage. She was an extraordinary woman. And I went to bed that night feeling like I was perhaps more than ordinary myself. This was the effect she had on me. Soon, we were conversing daily, Nila and I, usually in the late morning when she sat sipping coffee on the veranda. I would saunter over under the pretense of some task or other, and there I was, leaning against a shovel or tending to a cup of green tea, speaking to her. I felt privileged that she had chosen me. I was not the only servant, after all. I have already mentioned that unscrupulous toad Zahid, and there was a jowly-faced Hazara woman who came twice a week to wash laundry. But it was me she turned to. I was the only one, I believed, including her own husband, with whom her loneliness lifted. She usually did most of the talking, which suited me well. I was happy enough to be the vessel into which she poured her stories. She told me, for instance, of a hunting trip to Jalalabad she had taken with her father, and how she had been haunted for weeks by nightmares of dead deer with glassy eyes. She said she had gone with her mother to France when she was a child, before the Second World War. To get there, she had taken both a train and a ship. She described to me how she had felt the jostling of the train wheels in her ribs. And she remembered well the curtains that hung from hooks, and the separated compartments, and the rhythmic puff and hiss of the steam engine. She told me of the 6 weeks she had spent the year before in India with her father when she had been very ill. Now and then, when she turned to tap ash into a saucer, I stole a quick glance at the red polish on her toenails, at the gold-tinged sheen of her shaved calves, the high arch of her foot, and always at her full, perfectly shaped breasts. There were men walking this earth, I marveled, who had touched those breasts and kissed them as they had made love to her. What was left to do in life once you had done that? Where did a man go next once he'd stood at the world's summit? It was only with a great act of will that I would snap my eyes back to a safe spot when she turned to face me. As she grew more comfortable, she registered with me, during these morning chats, complaints about Mr. Watati. She said one day that she found him aloof and often arrogant. "He has been most generous to me," I said. She flapped one hand dismissively. "Please, Nabi, you don't have to do that." Politely, I turned my gaze downward. What she said was not entirely untrue. Mr. Watati did have, for instance, a habit of correcting my manner of speech with an air of superiority that could be interpreted, perhaps not wrongly, as arrogance. Sometimes I entered the room, placed a platter of sweets before him, refreshed his tea, wiped his crumbs off the table, and he would no more acknowledge me than he would a fly crawling up the screen door, shrinking me into insignificance without even lifting his eyes. In the end, though, this made for a minor quibble, given that I knew people living in the same neighborhood, people I had worked for, who beat their servants with sticks and belts. "He has no sense of fun or adventure," she said, listlessly stirring her coffee. "Sulaiman is a brooding old man trapped in a younger man's body." I was a little startled by her offhand candor. "It is true that Mr. Wahdati is uniquely comfortable with solitude," I said, opting for cautious diplomacy. "Maybe he should live with his mother. What do you think, Nabi? They make a good match, I tell you." Mr. Wahdati's mother was a heavy, rather pompous woman who lived in another part of town, with the obligatory team of servants and her two beloved dogs. These dogs she doted on and treated not as equals to her servants, but as superiors, and by several ranks at that. They were small, hairless, hideous creatures, easily startled, full of anxiety, and prone to a most grating, high-pitched bark. I despised them, for no sooner would I enter the house than they would hop on my legs and foolishly try to climb them. It was clear to me that every time I took Nila and Mr. Wahdati to the old woman's house, the air in the back seat would be heavy with tension, and I would know from the pained furrow on Nila's brow that they had quarreled. I remember that when my parents fought, they did not stop until a clear victor had been declared. It was their way of sealing off unpleasantness, to cock it with a verdict, keep it from leaking into the normalcy of the next day. Not so with the Wahdatis. Their fights did not so much end as dissipate, like a drop of ink in a bowl of water, with a residual taint that lingered. It did not take an act of intellectual acrobatics to surmise that the old woman had not approved of the union and that Nila knew it. As we carried on with these conversations, Nila and I, one question about her bubbled up again and again in my head. Why had she married Mr. Wahdati? I lacked the courage to ask. Such trespass of propriety was beyond me by nature. I could only infer that for some people, particularly women, marriage, even an unhappy one such as this, is an escape from even greater unhappiness. One day in the fall of 1950, Nila summoned me. "I want you to take me to Shadbagh," she said. She said she wanted to meet my family, see where I came from. She said I had served her meals and chauffeured her around Kabul for a year now, as she knew scarcely a thing about me. Her request confounded me, to say the least, as it was unusual for someone of her standing to ask to be taken some distance to meet the family of a servant. I was also, in equal measure, buoyed that Nila had taken such keen interest in me, and apprehensive, for I anticipated my discomfort, and yes, my shame, when I showed her the poverty into which I had been born. We set off on an overcast morning. She wore high heels and a peach sleeveless dress, but I didn't deem it my place to advise her otherwise. On the way, she asked questions about the village, the people I knew, my sister and Sabur, their children. "Tell me their names." "Well," I said, "there's Abdullah, who is nearly 9. His birth mother died last year, so he's my sister Parwana's stepson. His sister, Pari, is almost 2. Parwana gave birth to a baby boy this past winter. Omar, his name was. But he died when he was 2 weeks old." "What happened?" "Winter, Bibi Sahib. It descends on these villages and takes a random child or two every year. You can only hope it will bypass your home." "God," she muttered. "On a happier note," I said, "my sister is expecting again." At the village, we were greeted by the usual throng of barefoot children rushing the car. Though once Nila emerged from the back seat, the children grew quiet and pulled back, perhaps out of fear that she may chide them. But Nila displayed great patience and kindness. She knelt down and smiled, spoke to each of them, shook their hands, stroked their grubby cheeks, tousled their unwashed hair. To my embarrassment, people were gathering for a view of her. There was Baitullah, a childhood friend of mine, looking on from the edge of a roof, squatting with his brothers like a line of crows, all of them chewing Naswar tobacco. And there was his father, Mullah Shakib himself, and three white-bearded men sitting in the shade of a wall, listlessly fingering their prayer beads, their ageless eyes fixed on Nila and her bare arms with a look of displeasure. I introduced Nila to Sabur, and we made our way to his and Parwana's small mud house, trailed by a mob of onlookers. At the door, Nila insisted on taking off her shoes, though Sabur told her it was not necessary. When we entered the room, I saw Parwana sitting in a corner in silence, shriveled up into a stiff ball. She greeted Nila in a voice hardly above a whisper. Sabur flicked his eyebrows at Abdullah. "Bring some tea, boy." "Oh, no, please," Nila said, taking a seat on the floor beside Parwana. "It's not necessary." But Abdullah had already disappeared into the adjoining room, which I knew served both as kitchen and sleeping quarters for him and Pari. A cloudy plastic sheet nailed to the threshold separated it from the room where we had all gathered. I sat, toying with the car keys, wishing I had had the chance to warn my sister of the visit, give her time to clean up a bit. The cracked mud walls were black with soot, the ripped mattress beneath Nila layered with dust, the lone window in the room fly-specked. "This is a lovely carpet," Nila said cheerfully, running her fingers over the rug. It was bright red with elephant footprint patterns. It was the only object of any value that Sabur and Parwana owned, to be sold, as it turned out, that same winter. "It belonged to my father," Sabur said. "Is it a Turkoman rug?" "Yes." "I do love the sheep fleece they use. The craftsmanship is incredible." Sabur nodded his head. He didn't look her way once, even as he spoke to her. The plastic sheeting flapped when Abdullah returned with a tray of teacups and lowered it to the ground before Nila. He poured her a cup and sat cross-legged opposite her. Nila tried speaking to him, lobbing him a few simple questions, but Abdullah only nodded his shaved head, muttered a one- or two-word answer, and stared back at her guardedly. I made a mental note to speak to the boy, gently chide him about his manners. I would do it in a friendly way, for I liked the boy, who was serious and competent by nature. "How far along are you?" Nila asked Parwana. Her head down, my sister said the boy was due in the winter. "You are blessed," Nila said, "to be awaiting a baby, and to have such a polite young stepson." She smiled at Abdullah, who remained expressionless. Parwana muttered something that might have been, "Thank you." "And there's a little girl, too, if I recall," Nila said. "Pari?" "She's asleep," Abdullah said tersely. "Ah, I hear she's lovely." "Go fetch your sister," Sabur said. Abdullah lingered, looking from his father to Nila, then rose with visible reluctance to bring his sister. If I had any wish, even at this late hour, to somehow acquit myself, I would say that the bond between Abdullah and his little sister was an ordinary one. But it was not so. No one but God knows why those two had chosen each other. It was a mystery. I have never seen such affinity between two beings. In truth, Abdullah was as much father to Pari as sibling. When she was an infant, when she cried at night, it was he who sprung from the sleeping cot to walk her. It was he who took it upon himself to change her soiled linens, to bundle her up, to soothe her back to sleep. His patience with her was boundless. He carried her around the village, showing her off as though she were the world's most coveted trophy. When he carried a still groggy Pari into the room, Nila asked to hold her. Abdullah handed her over with a cutting look of suspicion, as though some instinctive alarm inside him had been set off. "Oh, she's darling," Nila exclaimed, her awkward bounces betraying her inexperience with small children. Pari gazed with confusion at Nila, looked toward Abdullah, and began to cry. Quickly, he retrieved her from Nila's hands. "Look at those eyes," Nila said. "Oh, and those cheeks. Isn't she darling, Nabi?" "That she is, Bibi Sahib," I said. "And she's been given the perfect name, Pari. She's indeed as beautiful as a fairy." Abdullah watched Nila, rocking Pari in his arms, his face growing cloudy. On the way back to Kabul, Nila slumped to the back seat, with her head resting on the glass. For a long while, she didn't say a word, and then, suddenly, she started to cry. I pulled the car over to the side of the road. She didn't speak for a long time. Her shoulders shook as she sobbed into her hands. Finally, she blew her nose into a handkerchief. "Thank you, Nabi," she said.
"For what, Bibi Sahib?"
"For taking me there. It was a privilege to meet your family."
"The privilege was all theirs and mine. We were honored."
"Your sister's children are beautiful." She removed her sunglasses and dabbed at her eyes. I considered for a moment what to do, at first opting to remain quiet. But she had wept in my presence, and the intimacy of the moment called for kind words. Softly, I said, "You will have your own soon, Bibi Sahib. Inshallah, God will see to it. You wait."
"I don't think he will. Even he can't see to this."
"Of course he can, Bibi Sahib. You're so very young. If he wishes it, it will happen."
"You don't understand," she said tiredly. I had never seen her look so exhausted, so drained. "It's gone. They scooped it all out of me in India. I'm hollow inside." To this, I could think of nothing to say. I longed to climb into the back seat beside her and pull her into my arms, to soothe her with kisses. Before I knew what I was doing, I had reached behind me and taken her hand into mine. I thought she would withdraw, but her fingers squeezed my hand gratefully, and we sat there in the car, not looking at each other, but at the plains around us, yellow and withering from horizon to horizon, furrowed with dried-up irrigation ditches, pocked with shrubs and rocks and stirrings of life here and there. Neela's hand in mine, I looked at the hills and the power poles. My eyes traced a cargo truck lumbering along in the distance, trailed by a puff of dust, and I would have happily sat there until dark.
"Take me home," she said at last, releasing my hand. "I'm going to turn in early tonight."
"Yes, Bibi Sahib." I cleared my throat and dropped the shift into the first gear with a slightly unsteady hand. She went into her bedroom and didn't leave it for days. This was not the first time. On occasion, she would pull up a chair to the window of her upstairs bedroom and plant herself there, smoking cigarettes, shaking one foot, staring out the window with a blank expression. She would not speak. She would not change out of her sleeping gown. She would not bathe or brush her teeth or hair. This time, she would not eat either, and this particular development caused Mr. Wahdati uncharacteristic alarm. On the fourth day, there was a knock at the front gates. I opened them to a tall, elderly man in a crisply pressed suit and shiny loafers. There was something imposing and rather forbidding about him, in the way he did not so much stand as loom, the way he looked right through me, the way he held his polished cane with both hands like it was a scepter. He had not said a word as yet, but I already sensed he was a man accustomed to being obeyed. "I understand my daughter is not well," he said. So he was the father. I had never met him before. "Yes, Sahib, I'm afraid that is true," I said. "Then move aside, young man." He pushed past me. In the garden I busied myself, chopping a block of wood for the stove. From where I worked, I had a good view of Neela's bedroom window. Framed in it was the father, bent at the waist, leaning into Neela, one hand pressing on her shoulder. On Neela's face was the expression people have when they have been startled by an abrupt loud noise, like a firecracker, or a door slammed by a sudden draft of wind. That night, she ate. A few days later, Neela summoned me into the house and said she was going to throw a party. We rarely, if ever, had parties at the house back when Mr. Wahdati was single. After Neela moved in, she arranged them two or three times a month. The day prior to the party, Neela would give me detailed instructions on what appetizers and meals I was to prepare, and I would drive to the market to purchase the necessary items. Chief among these necessary items was alcohol, which I had never procured before, as Mr. Wahdati did not drink. Though his reasons had nothing to do with religion, he merely disliked its effects. Neela, however, was well acquainted with certain establishments, pharmacies, as she called them jokingly, where for the equivalent of double my monthly salary, a bottle of medicine could be purchased subversively. I had mixed feelings about running this particular errand, playing the part of sin enabler. But, as always, pleasing Nila superseded everything else. You must understand, Mr. Marcos, that when we had parties in Chaudbourg, be it for a wedding or to celebrate a circumcision, the proceedings took place at two separate houses, one for women, the other for us men. At Nila's parties, men and women mingled with one another. Most of the women dressed as Nila did, in dresses that showed the entire lengths of their arms, and a good deal of their legs as well. They smoked, and they drank too, their glasses half filled with colorless, or red or copper-colored liquor, and they told jokes, and laughed, and freely touched the arms of men I knew to be married to someone else in the room. I carried small platters of bologna and lola kebab from one end of the smoke-filled room to the other, from one cluster of guests to another, as a record played on the turntable. The music was not Afghan, but something Nila called jazz, a kind of music that, I learned decades later, you appreciate as well, Mr. Marcos. To my ears, the random tinkling of piano and the strange wailing of horns sounded an inharmonious mess. But Nila loved it, and I kept overhearing her telling guests how they simply had to hear this recording or that. All night, she held a glass and tended to it far more than the food I served. Mr. Watati made limited effort to engage his guests. He made a token show of mingling, but mostly he occupied a corner, with a remote expression on his face, swirling a glass of soda, smiling a courteous, closed-mouthed smile when someone talked to him. And, as was his habit, he excused himself when the guests began asking Nila to recite her poetry. This was my favorite part by far of the evening. When she started, I always found some task that would keep me nearby. There I would be, frozen in place, towel in hand, straining to hear. Nina's poems did not resemble any I had grown up with. As you well know, we Afghans love our poetry. Even the most uneducated among us can recite verses of Hafez or Khayyam or Sa'di. Do you recall, Mr. Marcos, telling me last year how much you loved Afghans? And I asked you why, and you laughed and said, because even your graffiti artists spray Rumi on the walls. But Nila's poems defied tradition. They followed no preset meter or rhyming pattern, nor did they deal with the usual things, trees and spring flowers and bulbul birds. Nila wrote about love, and by love I do not mean the Sufi yearnings of Rumi or Hafez, but instead physical love. She wrote about lovers whispering across pillows, touching each other. She wrote about pleasure. I had never heard language such as this spoken by a woman. I would stand there, listening to Nila's smoky voice drift down the hallway, my eyes closed and my ears burning red, imagining she was reading to me, that we were the lovers in the poem, until someone's call for tea or fried eggs would break the spell, and then Nila would call my name, and I would run. That night, the poem she chose to read caught me off guard. It was about a man and his wife in a village, mourning the death of the infant they had lost to the winter cold. The guests seemed to love the poem, judging by the nods and the murmurs of approval around the room, and by the hearty applause when Nila looked up from the page. Still, I felt some surprise and disappointment that my sister's misfortune had been used to entertain guests, and I could not shake the sense that some vague betrayal had been committed. A couple of days after the party, Nila said she needed a new purse. Mr. Wahdati was reading the newspaper at the table where I served them a lunch of lentil soup and naan. "Do you need anything, Sulaiman?" Nila asked. "No, Aziz, thank you," he said. I rarely heard him address her by anything other than Aziz, which means beloved, darling. And yet never did the couple seem more distant from each other than when he said it. And never did this term of endearment sound so starched as when it came from Mr. Wahdati's lips. On the way to the store, Nila said she wanted to pick up a friend and gave me directions to the home. I parked on the street and watched her walk up the block to a two-story house with bright pink walls. At first, I left the engine running, but when 5 minutes passed and Nila hadn't returned, I shut it off. It was a good thing I did, for it was not until 2 hours later that I saw her slim figure gliding down the sidewalk toward the car. I opened the rear passenger door, and as she slid in, I smelled on her, underneath her own familiar perfume, a second scent, something faintly like cedarwood, and perhaps a trace of ginger, an aroma I recognized from having breathed it at the party 2 nights before. "I didn't find one I liked," Neela said from the back seat as she applied a fresh coat of lipstick. She caught my puzzled face in the rearview mirror. She lowered the lipstick and gazed at me from under her lashes. He took me to 2 different stores, but I couldn't find a purse to my liking. Her eyes locked onto mine in the mirror and lingered there a while, waiting, and I understood that I had been made privy to a secret. She was putting my allegiance to the test. She was asking me to choose. "I think maybe you visited 3 stores, I said weakly. She grinned. "Parfois je pense que tu es mon seul ami, Nabi." I blinked. "It means sometimes I think you are my only friend." She smiled radiantly at me, but it could not lift my sagging spirits. The rest of that day, I set about my chores at half my normal speed and with a fraction of my customary enthusiasm. When the men came over for tea that night, one of them sang for us, but his song failed to cheer me. I felt as though I had been the one cuckolded, and I was sure that the hold she had had on me had loosened at last. But in the morning I rose, and there it was, filling my living quarters once more, from floor to ceiling, seeping into the walls, saturating the air I breathed like vapor. It was no use, Mr. Marcos. I cannot tell you when, precisely, the idea took hold. Perhaps it was the windy autumn morning I was serving tea to Neela, when I had stooped and was cutting for her a slice of roast cake, that from the radio sitting on her windowsill came a report that the coming winter of 1952 might prove even more brutal than the last one. Perhaps it was earlier, the day I took her to the house with the bright pink walls, or perhaps earlier still, the time I held her hand in the car as she sobbed. Whatever the timing, once the idea entered my head, there was no purging it. Let me say, Mr. Marcos, that I proceeded with a mostly clean conscience, and with the conviction that my proposal was born of goodwill and honest intentions, something that, though painful in the short term, would lead to a greater long-term good for all involved. But I had less honorable, self-serving motives as well, chief among them this, that I would give Neela something no other man, not her husband, not the owner of that big pink house, could. I spoke to Sabur first. In my defense, I will say that if I had thought Sabur would accept money from me, I gladly would have given it to him in lieu of this proposal. I knew he needed the money, for he had told me of his struggles finding work. I would have borrowed an advance against my salary from Mr. Wadati for Sabur to see his family through the winter. But Sabur, like many of my countrymen, had the affliction of pride, an affliction both misbegotten and unshakable. He would never take money from me. When he married Parwana, he even put an end to the small remittances I had been giving her. He was a man, and he would provide for his own family. And he died doing just that, when he was not yet 40, collapsing one day while he was out harvesting a field of sugar beets somewhere near Baglon. I heard he died with the beet hook still in his blistered, bleeding hands. I was not a father, and thus will make no pretense at understanding the anguished deliberations that led to Sabu's decision. Nor was I privy to the discussions between the Wahdatis. Once I revealed the idea to Neela, I only asked that in her discussions with Mr. Wahdati, she put forth the idea as her own and not mine. I knew that Mr. Wahdati would resist. I had never glimpsed in him a sliver of paternal instinct. In fact, I had wondered if Neela's inability to bear children may have swayed his decision to marry her. Regardless, I steered clear of the tense atmosphere between the two. When I lay down to sleep at night, I saw only the sudden tears that had leaked from Neela's eyes when I told her, and how she had taken both my hands and gazed into me with gratitude, and, I was sure of it, something quite like love. I thought only of the fact that I was offering her a gift that men with far greater prospects could not. I thought only of how thoroughly I have given myself over to her, and how happily. And I thought, hoped, foolishly of course, that she may begin to see me as something more than the loyal servant. When Mr. Wahdati eventually buckled, which didn't surprise me, Nila was a woman of formidable will, I informed Sabur and offered to drive him and Pari to Kabul. I will never fully understand why he chose to instead walk his daughter from Shadbagh, or why he allowed Abdullah to come along. Perhaps he was clinging to what little time he had left with his daughter. Perhaps he sought a measure of penance in the hardship of the journey. Or perhaps it was Sabur's pride, and he would not ride in the car of the man who was buying his daughter. But in the end, there they were, the three of them, coated in dust, waiting, as agreed, near the mosque. As I drove them to the Wahdati home, I did my best to seem cheerful for the children's benefit, the children who were oblivious to their fate, and to the terrible scene that would soon unfold. There's little point in recounting it in detail, Mr. Marcos, that scene that did unfold precisely as I had feared. But all these years later, I still feel my heart clench when the memory of it forces its way to the fore. How could it not? I took those two helpless children, in whom love of the simplest and purest kind had found expression, and I tore one from the other. I will never forget the sudden emotional mayhem. Pari slung over my shoulder, panic-stricken, kicking her legs, shrieking, "Abdullah! Abdullah!" as I whisked her away. Abdullah, screaming his sister's name, trying to fight past his father. Nila, wide-eyed, her mouth covered with both hands, perhaps to silence her own scream. It weighs on me. All this time has passed, Mr. Marcos, and it still weighs on me. Pari was nearly 4 years old at the time, but despite her young age, there were forces in her life that needed to be reshaped. She was instructed not to call me Koko Nabi any longer, for instance, but simply Nabi, and her mistakes were gently corrected, by me included, over and over, until she came to believe that we bore no relation to each other. I became for her Nabi the cook and Nabi the driver. Nila became Maman, and Mr. Wahdati, Papa. Nila set about teaching her French, which had been her own mother's tongue. Mr. Wahdati's chilly reception of Pari lasted only a brief time, before, perhaps to his own surprise, little Pari's tearful anxiety and homesickness disarmed him. Soon, Pari joined us on our morning strolls. Mr. Wahdati lowered her into a stroller and pushed her around the neighborhood as we walked. Or else, he sat her up on his lap behind the wheel of the car and smiled patiently while she pushed the horn. He hired a carpenter and had him build a three-drawer trundle bed for Pari, a maple chest for toys, and a small short armoire. He had all the furniture in Pari's room painted yellow since he had discovered this was her favorite color. And I found him one day sitting cross-legged before the armoire, Pari at his side, as he painted with rather remarkable skill giraffes and long-tailed monkeys over its doors. It should speak volumes about his private nature, Mr. Marcos, when I tell you that in all the years I had watched him sketch, this was the first time I had actually laid eyes on his artwork. One of the effects of Pari's entrance was that for the first time, the Wahdati household resembled a proper family. Bound now by their affection for Pari, Nila and her husband took all their meals together. They walked Pari to a nearby park and sat contentedly beside each other on a bench to watch her play. When I served them tea at night after I had cleared the table, I often found one or the other reading a children's book to Pari as she reclined on their laps, she, with each passing day, more forgetful of her past life in Shadbagh and of the people in it. The other consequence of Pari's arrival was one I had not anticipated. I receded into the background. Judge me charitably, Mr. Marcos, and remember that I was a young man, but I admit I had hopes, foolish as they might have been. I was the instrument of Nila's becoming a mother, after all. I had uncovered the source of her unhappiness and delivered an antidote. Did I think we would become lovers now? I want to say I was not so foolish as that, Mr. Marcos, but that wouldn't be entirely truthful. I suspect the truth is that we are waiting, all of us, against insurmountable odds, for something extraordinary to happen to us. What I did not foresee was that I would fade away. Paris consumed Nila's time now. Lessons, games, naps, walks, more games. Our daily chats went by the wayside. If the two of them were playing with building blocks or working on a puzzle, Nila would hardly notice that I had brought her coffee, that I was still in the room, standing back on my heels. When we did speak, she seemed distracted, always eager to cut the conversation short. In the car, her expression was distant. For this, though it shames me, I will admit to feeling a shade of resentment toward my niece. As part of the agreement with the Wahdatis, Paris' family was not allowed to visit. They were not allowed any contact at all with her. I drove to Shadbagh one day soon after Paris moved in with the Wahdatis. I went there bearing a small present each for Abdullah and for my sister's little boy, Iqbal, who was a toddler by then. Sabur said pointedly, "You've given your gifts. Now it's time to go." I told him I didn't understand the reason for his cold reception, his gruff manner with me. "You do understand," he said. "I don't feel like you have to come out and see us anymore." He was right. I did understand. A chill had grown between us. My visit had been awkward, tense, even contentious. It felt unnatural to sit together now, to sip tea and chat about the weather or that year's grape harvest. We were feigning a normalcy, Sabur and I, that no longer was. Whatever the reason, I was, in the end, the instrument of his family's rupture. Sabur did not want to set eyes on me again, and I understood. I stopped my monthly visits. I never saw any of them again. It was one day early in the spring of 1955, Mr. Marcos, that the lives of all of us in the household changed forever. I remember it was raining, not the galling kind that draws frogs out to croak, but an indecisive drizzle that had come and gone all morning. I remember because the gardener, Zahid, was there, being his habitual lazy self, leaning on a rake and saying how he might call it a day on account of the nasty weather. I was about to retreat to my shack, if only to get away from his drivel, when I heard Nila screaming my name from inside the main house. I rushed across the yard to the house. Her voice was coming from upstairs, from the direction of the master bedroom. I found Nila in a corner, back to the wall, palm clasped over her mouth. "Something's wrong with him," she said, not removing her hand. Mr. Wahdati was sitting up in bed, dressed in a white undershirt. He was making strange guttural sounds. His face was pale and drawn, his hair disheveled. He was repeatedly trying and failing to perform some task with his right arm, and I noticed with horror that a line of spittle was streaking down from the corner of his mouth. "Nabi, do something!" Paris, who was six by then, had come into the room, and now she scampered over to Mr. Wahdati's bedside and pulled on his undershirt. "Papa? Papa?" He looked down at her, wide-eyed, his mouth opening and closing. She screamed. I picked her up quickly and took her to Nila. I told Nila to take the child to another room because she must not see her father in this condition. Nila blinked, as if breaking a trance, looked from me to Paris before she reached for her. She kept asking me what was wrong with her husband. She kept saying that I must do something. I summoned Zahid from the window, and for once the good-for-nothing fool proved of some use. He helped me put a pair of pajama pants on Mr. Wahdati. We lifted him off the bed, carried him down the stairs, and lowered him into the back seat of the car. Nila climbed in next to him. I told Zahid to stay at the house and look after Paris. He started to protest, and I struck him, open-palmed across the temple as hard as I could. I told him he was a donkey and that he must do as he was told. And with that, I backed out of the driveway and peeled out. It was 2 full weeks before we brought Mr. Wahdati home. Chaos ensued. Family descended upon the house in hordes. I was brewing tea and cooking food almost around the clock to feed this uncle, that cousin, an elderly aunt. All day the front gate's bell rang and heels clicked on the marble floor of the living room and murmurs rippled in the hallway as people spilled into the house. Most of them I had rarely seen at the house, and I understood that they were clocking in an appearance more to pay respect to Mr. Wahdati's matronly mother than to see the reclusive sick man with whom they had but a tenuous connection. She came too, of course, the mother, minus the dogs, thank goodness. She burst into the house bearing a handkerchief in each hand to blot at her reddened eyes and dripping nose. She planted herself at his bedside and wept. Also, she wore black, which appalled me, as though her son were already dead. And in a way he was, at least the old version of him. Half of his face was now a frozen mask. His legs were almost of no service. He had movement of the left arm, but the right was only bone and flaccid meat. He spoke with hoarse grunts and moans that no one could decipher. The doctor told us that Mr. Wahdati felt emotions as he had before the stroke, and he understood things well. But what he could not do, at least for the time being, was to act on what he felt and understood. This was not entirely true, however. Indeed, after the first week or so, he made his feelings quite clear about the visitors, his mother included. He was, even in such extreme sickness, a fundamentally solitary creature. And he had no use for their pity, their woebegone looks, all the forlorn head-shaking at the wretched spectacle he had become. When they entered his room, he waved his functional left hand in an angry shooing motion. When they spoke to him, he turned his cheek. If they sat at his side, he clutched a handful of bedsheet and grunted and pounded the fist against his hip until they left. With Paris, his dismissal was no less insistent, if far gentler. She came to play with her dolls at his bedside, and he looked up at me pleadingly, his eyes watering, his chin quivering, until I led her out of the room. He did not try to speak with her, for he knew his speech upset her. The great visitor exodus came as a relief to Nila. When people were packing the house wall to wall, Nila retreated upstairs into Paris' bedroom with her, much to the disgust of the mother-in-law, who doubtless expected, and really who could blame her, Nila to remain at her son's side, at least for the sake of appearances, if nothing else. Of course, Nila cared nothing about appearances or what might be said about her, and plenty was. "What sort of wife is this?" I heard the mother-in-law exclaim more than once. She complained to anyone who would listen that Nila was heartless, that she had a gaping hole in her soul. Where was she now that her husband needed her? What sort of wife abandoned her loyal, loving husband? Some of what the old woman said, of course, was accurate. Indeed, it was I who could be found most reliably at Mr. Wahdati's bedside. I who gave him his pills and greeted those who entered the room. It was me to whom the doctor spoke most often, and therefore it was me, and not Nila, whom people asked about Mr. Wahdati's condition. Mr. Wahdati's dismissal of visitors relieved Nila of one discomfort, but presented her with another. By holing up in Paris' room and closing the door, she had kept herself at a remove not only from the disagreeable mother-in-law, but also from the mess that her husband had become. Now the house was vacant, and she faced spousal duties for which she was uniquely ill-suited. She couldn't do it, and she didn't. I'm not saying she was cruel or callous. I have lived a long time, Mr. Marcos, and one thing I have come to see is that one is well served by a degree of both humility and charity when judging the inner workings of another person's heart. What I am saying is that I walked into Mr. Wahdati's room one day and found Nila sobbing into his belly, a spoon still in her hand, as pureed lentil dal dripped from his chin onto the bib tied around his neck. "Let me, Bibi Sahib," I said gently. I took the spoon from her, wiped his mouth clean, and went to feed him, but he moaned, squeezed his eyes shut, and turned his face. It was not long after that I was lugging a pair of suitcases down the stairs and handing them to a driver, who stowed them in the trunk of his idling car. I helped Paris, who was wearing her favorite yellow coat, climb into the back seat. "Nabi, will you bring Papa and visit us in Paris, like Maman said?" she asked, giving me her gap-toothed smile. I told her I certainly would when her father felt better. I kissed the back of each of her little hands. "Bibi Paris, I wish you luck, and I wish you happiness," I said. I met Neela as she came down the front steps with puffy eyes and smudged eyeliner. She had been in Mr. Wathethi's room saying her goodbyes. I asked her how he was. "Relieved, I think," she said, then added, "although that may be my wishful thinking." She closed the zipper to her purse and slung the strap over her shoulder. "Don't tell anyone where I'm going. It would be for the best." I promised her I would not. She told me she would write soon. She then looked me long in the eyes, and I believe I saw genuine affection there. She touched my face with the palm of her hand. "I'm happy, Nebi, that you're with him." Then she pulled close and embraced me, her cheek against mine. My nose filled with the scent of her hair, her perfume. "It was you, Nebi," she said in my ear. "It was always you. Didn't you know?" I didn't understand, and she broke from me before I could ask. Head lowered, boot heels clicking against the asphalt, she hurried down the driveway. She slid into the back seat of the taxi next to Paris, looked my way once, and pressed her palm against the glass. Her palm, white against the window, was the last I saw of her as the car pulled away from the driveway. I watched her go and waited for the car to turn at the end of the street before I pulled the gates shut. Then I leaned against them and wept like a child. Despite Mr. Wathethi's wishes, a few visitors still trickled in, at least for a short while longer. Eventually, it was only his mother who turned up to see him. She came once a week or so. She would snap her fingers at me, and I would pull up a chair for her. And no sooner had she plopped down next to her son's bed than she would launch into a soliloquy of assaults on the character of his now departed wife. She was a harlot, a liar, a drunk, a coward who had run to God knows where when her husband needed her most. This, Mr. Wathethi would bear in silence, looking impassively past her shoulder at the windows. Then came an interminable stream of news and updates, much of it almost physically painful in its banality. A cousin who had argued with her sister because her sister had had the gall to buy the same exact coffee table as she. Who had got a flat tire on the way home from Parmont last Friday? Who had got a new haircut? On and on. Sometimes Mr. Wathethi would grunt something, and his mother would turn to me. "You, what did he say?" She always addressed me in this manner, her words sharp and angular. Because I was at his side more or less all day, I had slowly come to unlock the enigma of his speech. I would lean in close, and what sounded to others like unintelligible groans and mumbles, I would recognize as a request for water, for the bedpan, an appeal to be turned over. I had become his de facto interpreter. "Your son says he would like to sleep." The old woman would sigh and say it was just as well, she ought to be going anyway. She would lean down and kiss his brow and promise to come back soon. Once I had walked her out to the front gates, where her own chauffeur awaited her, I would return to Mr. Wathethi's room and sit on a stool next to his bed, and we would relish the silence together. Sometimes his eyes caught mine, and he would shake his head and grin crookedly. Because the work I had been hired for was so limited now, I drove only to get groceries once or twice a week, and I had to cook for only two people, I saw little sense in paying the other servants for work that I could perform. I expressed this to Mr. Wathethi, and he motioned with his hand. I leaned in. "You'll wear yourself out." "No, Sahib, I'm happy to do it." He asked me if I was sure, and I told him I was. His eyes watered, and his fingers closed weakly around my wrist. He had been the most stoic man I had ever known, but since the stroke, the most trivial things made him agitated, anxious, tearful.
"Nebi, listen to me."
"Yes, Sahib."
"Pay yourself any salary you like."
I told him we had no need to talk about that.
"You know where I keep the money."
"Get your rest, Sahib."
"I don't care how much."
I said I was thinking of making shorwa soup for lunch. "How does that sound, shorwa? I would like some myself, come to think of it." I put an end to the evening gatherings with the other workers. I no longer cared what they thought of me. I would not have them come to Mr. Wathethi's house and amused themselves at his expense. I had the considerable pleasure of firing Zayed. I also let go of the Hazara woman who came in to wash clothes. Thereafter, I washed the laundry and hung it on a clothesline to dry. I tended to the trees, trimmed the shrubs, mowed the grass, planted new flowers and vegetables. I maintained the house, sweeping the rugs, polishing the floors, beating dust from the curtains, washing the windows, fixing leaky faucets, replacing rusty pipes. One day, I was up in Mr. Wahdati's room dusting cobwebs from the moldings while he slept. It was summer, and the heat was fierce and dry. I had taken all the blankets and sheets off Mr. Wahdati and rolled up the legs of his pajama pants. I had opened the windows. The fan overhead wheeled creakily, but it was little use. The heat pushed in from every direction. There was a rather large closet in the room I had been meaning to clean for some time, and I decided to finally get to it that day. I slid the doors open and started in on the suits, dusting each one individually, though I recognized that in all probability Mr. Wahdati would never don any of them again. There were stacks of books on which dust had collected, and I wiped those as well. I cleaned his shoes with a cloth and lined them all up in a neat row. I found a large cardboard box, nearly shielded from view by the hems of several long winter coats draping over it. I pulled it toward me and opened it. It was full of Mr. Wahdati's old sketchbooks, one stacked atop another, each a sad relic of his past life. I lifted the top sketchbook from the box and randomly opened it to a page. My knees nearly buckled. I went through the whole book. I put it down and picked up another, then another, and another, and another after that. The pages flipped before my eyes, each fanning my face with a little sigh, each bearing the same subject drawn in charcoal. Here I was, wiping the front fender of the car as seen from the perch of the upstairs bedroom. Here I was, leaning on a shovel by the veranda. I could be found on these pages tying my shoelaces, chopping wood, watering bushes, pouring tea from kettles, praying, napping. Here was the car parked along the banks of Gharqa Lake, me behind the wheel, the window rolled down, my arm hanging over the side of the door, a dimly drawn figure in the back seat, birds circling overhead. It was you, Nabi. It was always you. Didn't you know? I looked over to Mr. Wahdati. He was sleeping soundly on his side. I carefully placed the sketchbooks back in the cardboard box, closed the top, and pushed the box back in the corner beneath the winter coats. Then I left the room, shutting the door softly so as not to wake him. I walked down the dim hallway and down the stairs. I saw myself walk on, step out into the heat of that summer day, make my way down the driveway, push out the front gates, stride down the street, turn a corner, and keep walking, without looking over my shoulder. How was I to stay on now? I wondered. I was neither disgusted nor flattered by the discovery I had made, Mr. Marcos, but I was discomfited. I tried to picture how I could stay, knowing what I knew now. It cast a pall over everything, what I had found in the box. A thing like this could not be escaped, pushed aside. Yet how could I leave while he was in such a helpless state? I could not. Not without first finding someone suitable to take over my duties. I owed Mr. Wahdati at least that much, because he had always been good to me, while I, on the other hand, had maneuvered behind his back to gain his wife's favors. I went to the dining room and sat at the glass table with my eyes closed. I cannot tell you how long I sat there without moving, Mr. Marcos, only that at some point I heard stirrings from upstairs, and I blinked my eyes open and saw that the light had changed, and then I got up and set a pot of water to boil for tea. One day, I went up to his room and told him I had a surprise for him. This was sometime in the late 1950s. Long before television had made its way to Kabul. He and I passed our time those days playing cards, and of late chess, which he had taught me and for which I was showing a bit of a knack. We also spent considerable time with reading lessons. He proved a patient teacher. He would close his eyes as he listened to me read and shake his head gently when I erred. "Again," he would say. By then, his speech had improved quite dramatically over time. "Read that again, Nabi." I had been more or less literate when he had hired me back in 1947, thanks to Mullah Shakib, but it was through Sulaiman's tutoring that my reading truly advanced, as did my writing by consequence. He did it to help me, of course, but there was also a self-serving element to the lessons, for I now could read to him books that he liked. He could read them on his own, naturally, but only for short bursts, as he tired easily. If I was in the midst of a chore and could not be with him, he didn't have much to occupy himself with. He listened to records. Often, he had to make do with looking out the window, at the birds perched on the trees, the sky, the clouds, and listened to the children playing on the street, the fruit vendors pulling their donkeys, chanting, "Cherries! Fresh cherries!" When I told him about this surprise, he asked me what it was. I slid my arm under his neck and told him we were going downstairs first. In those days, I had little trouble carrying him, for I was still young and able. I lifted him with ease and carried him to the living room, where I gently reclined him on the sofa. "Well," he said. I pushed in the wheelchair from the foyer. For over a year, I had lobbied for it, and he had obstinately refused. Now, I had taken the initiative and bought one anyway. Immediately, he was shaking his head. "Is it the neighbors?" I said. "Are you embarrassed by what people will say?" He told me to take him back upstairs. "Well, I don't give one damn what the neighbors think or say," I said. "So, what we're going to do today is go for a walk. It's a lovely day, and we are going for a walk, you and I, and that is that. Because if we don't get out of this house, I'm going to lose my mind. And where would that leave you if I went insane? And honestly, Sulaiman, quit your crying. You're like an old woman." Now he was crying and laughing, and still saying, "No, no," even as I lifted him and lowered him into the wheelchair, and as I covered him with a blanket and wheeled him through the front door. It would merit mentioning here that I did, at first, search for a replacement for myself. I did not tell Sulaiman I was doing so. I thought it best to find the right person and then bring the news to him. A number of people came to inquire about the work. I met with them outside the house so as to not rouse suspicion in Sulaiman. But the search proved far more problematic than I had anticipated. Some of the candidates were clearly made of the same cloth as Zahid, and those, whom I sniffed out easily due to my lifelong dealings with their sort, I dismissed swiftly. Others didn't have the necessary cooking skills, for, as I had mentioned earlier, Sulaiman was a rather fussy eater. Or they couldn't drive. Many could not read, which was a serious impediment now that I had habitually read to Sulaiman late in the afternoons. Some I found to be impatient, another grave shortcoming when it came to caring for Sulaiman, who could be exasperating and at times childishly petulant. Others I intuitively judged to lack the necessary temperament for the arduous task at hand. And so, 3 years on, I was still at the house, still telling myself I intended to leave once I felt assured Sulaiman's fate was in hands I could trust. 3 years on, I was still the one washing his body every other day with a wet cloth, shaving his face, clipping his nails, cutting his hair. I fed him his food and helped him on the bedpan, and I wiped him clean the way you do an infant, and I washed the soiled diapers I pinned on him. In that time, we had developed between us an unspoken language born of familiarity and routine, and inevitably, a degree of previously unthinkable informality had seeped into our relationship. Once I got him to agree to the wheelchair, the old ritual of morning strolls was restored. I wheeled him out of the house, and we would go down the street and say hello to the neighbors as we passed by. One of them was Mr. Bashiri, a young recent graduate of Kabul University who worked for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. He, his brother, and their respective wives had moved into a big two-story home 3 houses down across the street from us. Sometimes we ran into him as he was warming up his car in the morning to go to work, and I always stopped for a few pleasantries. I often wheeled Sulaiman over to Chardinal Park, where we sat in the shade of the elms and watched the traffic, the taxi drivers pounding palms against horns, the ding-a-ding of bicycles, donkeys braying,